Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Last week, Mayor Adams signed Healthy NYC into law, codifying his goal of helping New Yorkers live to at least 83 years old by 2030. This is an explicit life expectancy goal, 83 on average. This comes after the city saw its average life expectancy drop to 78 in 2020 due to COVID-19. It started to recover since then, but not all the way. And it's not just COVID causing premature deaths. Chronic illness and overdoses are sending many to an early grave, keeping lifespans below pre-pandemic levels. So we're going to talk about some of the numbers, and of course it's different by different groups, and we'll delve into the specifics of the Healthy NYC plan and some other local public health news with the New York City Health and Mental Hygiene Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasan. Dr. Vasan, always good to have you on the program. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, great to be back, Brian.
Do you want to do a quick top line statistical overview of life expectancy among New York City residents? What was it? What is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this plan comes out of this very basic realization that something's wrong when in the richest city, in the richest country, in the most, I guess, ostensibly powerful nation in the world, that our life expectancy is actually falling or flatlining and nationally, and that it's not keeping pace with our peer country. So that's a lot of this comes out of this very American story of stagnating life expectancy over the last decade. And then, of course, COVID hit and took a uniquely damaging toll on New York. In 2020 alone, this city lost 4.6 years of life expectancy, dropping from 82.6 years in 2019 to 78 years. And those drops were more dramatic for Black New Yorkers, who not only experienced 5.5 years of life expectancy loss, but started at a lower baseline, 6 years drop for Latino New Yorkers. And as you mentioned in your lead up, the causes are not just COVID related, but you start to see other causes of death moving in the wrong directions, like overdose, suicide, chronic illnesses, widening Black maternal mortality. And so while the numbers are a little bit encouraging that we regained some years of life expectancy to about 80.7 years citywide in 2021, what we said to ourselves, and what's clear, is that it's not inevitable that we are just going to get back to where we were prior to COVID. And frankly, the pre-COVID story wasn't all that encouraging. While New York is better than the nation, the American life expectancy is still stagnating around 76 years. While New York is better than the nation, over the last decade, we've seen a rising toll of things like deaths of despair due to suicide, the effects of alcoholism and overdose, that are starting to see American life expectancy stagnate. And so this is our GPS coordinates. This plan, Healthy NYC, is very much the North Star of where we want to head as a city in the post-COVID era, so that we can reset this expectation that healthier, longer lives for all New Yorkers is a central organizing function of our city. And the fact that the mayor signed the Healthy NYC bill into law is actually a wonderful codification of this. And it means it's not going to die or be subject to the vagaries of any one political cycle or one administration, but that it's going to be a permanent feature of our planning for years and decades to come.
And we'll talk about what the plan actually entails and how you hope it will decrease premature deaths. But I want to ask you to comment on the racial or ethnic disparities in longevity as they exist. One stat that I saw that's a New York stat is that Black New Yorkers had the lowest life expectancy among the major racial or ethnic groups at about 76 years, while white New Yorkers had the highest at about 82 years. That's such a big difference, 6 years of life on average. I saw some national statistics in an article, and tell me if you think these are right. that had Asian Americans with the longest life expectancy at around 85, then Latinos around 80, and then whites around 78, and then Black Americans around 73 nationally, and the shortest life expectancy, Native Americans, at around 68. So how much of any of that sounds right to you?
No, those are right. Those are correct numbers, and it's very disturbing numbers. And any bad faith actors out there who want to make statements that somehow racism isn't real and it isn't a public health crisis just needs to look at the data. You know, those are enormous gaps in life expectancy. And we know here in the city of New York that that plays out block to block, zip code to zip code. You know, if you take the subway from the Upper East Side to Central Brooklyn, the life expectancy gap is on the order of 10 to 11 years. And so we have real issues around racial equity. And that's why Healthy NYC is explicit that there isn't a path to getting to healthier, longer lives. There isn't a path to reaching our life expectancy goal in 2030 that doesn't center equity. And so what does that mean? That means really ensuring that our programs and our investments are getting into those zip codes and into the communities where we can start to stave off premature death, that is death below the age of 65, because we know that those premature deaths contribute disproportionately to the stagnating and falling life expectancy we're seeing. So racial equity is central to this plan, but there's also other strategies as well. So, you know, when we think about tobacco control, or when we think about continued improvements in our food systems, reducing those risk factors for all New Yorkers citywide is also crucial. So that's really what this plan is about. It's about prevention. It's about place-based investments, making sure that our programs and our dollars are getting into the communities where it'll make the biggest difference. And it's also, we're very explicit, it's about the communities that are most vulnerable to begin with, people who live in congregate settings like shelters and nursing homes, people who live with disabilities, people who are unhoused or unstably housed. We need to be centering those people in our planning as well. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach.
If you're affirming those national numbers that I read, it would probably surprise people that Latinos live on average a couple of more years than white Americans, because there would be more of the racism that you cite and more poverty, certainly in the Latino communities in the United States. And I realize those communities are extremely diverse, but on average, is that true in New York? Do Latinos in New York live a little longer than whites on average?
Yeah, but we know how fragile that is. Yes, Latinos are at or around the same levels as white New Yorkers, but they took the steepest drop in 2020. 6 years of life expectancy lost in 1 year. That's the steepest drop in the country and in the world in 2020 in any one group. New York City took the steepest drop in the country and in the world in 1 year in 2020. And so what that tells you about Hispanic New Yorkers and Latino New Yorkers is that while they might be healthier and living longer at baseline, it's incredibly precarious. And we know that to be true, right? People working in the informal economy, people who are uninsured or unstably uninsured to receive basic health care and primary care and preventive screenings, you know, all it takes is one big health shock like COVID or some other health issue to really make that much more precarious and to shorten lives. So I don't think it tells the full picture. I wouldn't conclude from that somehow Latino New Yorkers are permanently and fundamentally healthier. It's really that it's really about that precarity and that instability that
right.
So many people face.
So I hear what you're saying about the precarity or precariousness, but what makes Latino New Yorkers, what are the conditions that contribute to living about as long as white people who tend to have higher incomes, you know, less risky jobs, those things? You have anything on that?
Well, look, first, no, Latinos are not a monolith, right? I mean, it's tens of countries around South America, even Western Europe and other places around the world. So that's an important caveat here. It's not a monolith. Number two, we know that just immigration patterns, people tend to come here earlier in life. People tend to come. Latino New Yorkers are structurally younger in New York City than other demographic groups on balance. And whether they're a part of the formal economy or informal economy, Latino New Yorkers have higher workforce engagement than some other groups. And so I think all of that, even if income levels are not the same, active and also types of work as well, you know, physical labor, manual labor, work in service industries. I mean, those are all contributing to more activity and certainly associated with some characteristics of better health. But it's a complex story for sure.
Listeners, who has a call about life expectancy in New York and what can improve it in general and what can make it more equal across groups for the New York City Health and Mental Hygiene Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasan, on the occasion of Mayor Adams signing Healthy NYC into law, which has a goal of average New York City life expectancy of 83. 212-433-WNYC, call or text 212-433-9692. Listener writes, how does the ability to eat healthy affect life expectancy in the different ethnic groups?
I mean, massively in general, and of course there are group-specific differences. We set a goal within Healthy NYC. So the way that Healthy NYC is structured is it sets out a life expectancy goal for the city by 2030. But to reach that goal, it sets out very specific mortality reduction targets for the leading causes of death, premature death, and what we call excess death. So that's usually deaths that happen out of proportion than are what we would expect. And one of the goals is to reduce heart disease and diabetes related deaths by 5% by 2030. That might not sound like a lot, but it's actually profound because we've seen real persistent high levels of heart disease and diabetes related deaths in our city. And we haven't really been able to move the needle. Diet is a major driver of both of those things. In fact, they're often colloquially referred to as diet related diseases because we know that our diet is such a major contributor to the development of both stroke, heart disease, and diabetes. And so the things we're doing and have done, the things that the Bloomberg administration was known for in terms of reducing eliminating trans fats, their effort to address sugar sweetened beverages in society, the things that we're doing to increase incentives for people to create to get fresh and healthy foods. We launched a program called Groceries to Go during the pandemic, which was about getting people access to green grocery, basically, at a subsidized level. So all of these things are really essential to not just manage and live with a chronic illness like heart disease or diabetes or diet-related diseases, but frankly and importantly, to prevent it. It's also important to note the links between diet and cancer. We've set a goal to reduce screenable cancers by 10%, by 20% by 2030. And you can imagine some of those are incredibly related to diet, especially things like colon cancer. So this is it's a huge issue. And what you'll see in Healthy NYC is a set of strategies that are all the way upstream to things like food policy, tobacco control, you know, big structural policy, all the way down to access to care and very granular community-based programs.
We're getting a lot of texts and calls on the question of why Latino New Yorkers and Latino Americans generally live as long as or longer than whites. A lot of them run along the lines of this text, which says, we Latinos move more and have lifestyles of working physically demanding jobs, strong social connections, and eat more whole foods. A number of them highlight the social connections. Another one says, regarding Latinos living longer, community and close family relationships translates to longevity. And one more on this track, Josie in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Josie, thank you for calling in. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I think about diet, principally. Immigrant Latinos, well, I'll speak for Mexicans. Mexicans have a very healthy diet. And so I think we are a young immigrant community here. And so they still eat their food, the practices they have from home. And the reason our mortality rates were so high during COVID is because those undocumented workers were the essential workers. So they were more exposed to COVID. But what you find in the studies is that after a generation or two, then Latinos start eating really U.S. kind of more American diets. But the first couple of generations eat, you know, beans, rice, tortillas, and a light protein, you know.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and thanks for making that comment. So there's actually, without getting too wonky into demography and epidemiology, there's actually a phenomenon called the Hispanic epidemiological paradox, which is really, for the last three decades or more, people are trying to understand this question, four decades, really trying to understand this question, why despite socioeconomic disadvantages, why do Latino Americans live as long, or even in some populations around the country, tend to outlive non-Hispanic whites? And a couple of things that have been mentioned, you know, higher rates of physically demanding work, especially early in life, traditional diets, more whole foods in those diets, lower rates of smoking and tobacco use in the Latino community, and social networks, particularly through family and church, is associated. Social connection and loneliness, of course, being factors for worsened health. So I think there are some structural issues that also carry, despite the fact that Latinos are not a monolith, there's a lot of commonality in that. And the caller is absolutely right. That starts to fade over time as, we've seen this in population after population, whether it's Asians coming over to the United States or Latinos. Over time, they adopt features of the uniquely American lifestyle, which is, higher rates of processed foods and less activity and more sedentary lifestyle, which actually ends up negating some of those effects over time.
Sam in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Health Commissioner Vossen. Hi, Sam.
Hi, good morning. So I was listening to this, and what I'm thinking is for the Black population is weathering, number one. Weathering is the premature aging of self, and there's research being done on this that Black people in America experience biological aging of the cells based on all the stresses of having been a historically criminalized population. So that historical criminalization that goes back several centuries, even in New York City, has created lack of access to affordable housing, to decent housing and home ownership, and the destruction of communities, and equal medical care, and the list just continues. And one other thing I would like to say is, as a Black mother myself, raising sons in particular is very stressful, because once they get past a certain age, you see how people react to your sons differently. All of a sudden, once they get past like 6 or 7, at best maybe 9, people see them differently. They now they're a threat. So your boys, as well as your girls, but your boys grow up not knowing if they're going to be shot by people on the street or by police officers, if they're going to be stopped when they go on the subway, when they get on the train, just living, just mm-hmm. doing normal things. And it's also happening with the girls. So the kids are growing up stressed. The parents are stressed. The stress leads to bad habits like smoking, drinking. It also increases mental illness. But then there's not effective care for people with mental illness. So it's like a cycle. And then if you can't find a decent place to live, or your rent goes up and your job is not paying enough, your income doesn't go up, if you're working very difficult, physically demanding jobs, and you don't have enough time to just relax.
Yes. All
and
of it all, these all contributes to the weather.
All of it.
Brian, if
started
I could.
With.
Yes.
Sam, thank you very much. And Commissioner, I think you should hire Sam as the Assistant Deputy Health Commissioner,
Sam,
right? Because there it
so
all
well,
is.
Well said. So well said, Sam. You know, weathering is a well-described phenomenon that particularly affects communities that have been on the receiving end of injustice and racial injustice. In specific, in this country, Arlene Geronimus at the University of Michigan wrote a fantastic book called Weathering on this very subject. And it's also related to this concept of allostatic load, which is essentially the wearing down of the body due to cumulative stress and stress hormones. If you have higher rates of stress hormones like cortisol, for instance, in your body all the time or more frequently than other groups, that really over time impacts your blood vessels, it impacts your cells, it shortens your telomeres, which are the ends of your chromosomes, which are associated with aging and premature aging. So that is a very real phenomenon. It's why the health department and why this city declared racism a public health crisis, right? People asked us when we launched that initiative, why did you do that? What does it actually mean? This is what it means. It has a real toll on the body. The effects of racism, intergenerational racism, has an impact on the body. And now we know how to measure it biologically. It's not, even if you control for these other factors of economics and educational status, you see the physiological effects of racism on the body. And it's very clear that weathering plays a role in the persistent lower life expectancy of Black New Yorkers. Again, it's why in Healthy NYC, we are so focused on balancing overall approaches of the city with place-based approaches, really driving our work into the zip codes and into the neighborhoods that we know people already have worse underlying health status due to things like racism.
Yeah. For people interested in reading more about weathering, we've had New York Times journalist Linda Villarosa on the show, and she writes a lot about weathering. So check out Linda Villarosa's New York Times articles, I guess, on the web, on their site, if you're interested in more on that. One more listener comment. Listener writes, I have lost 3 friends in the last 2 years to drug overdoses. None of them are what you would consider an addict, just recreational users, and I think the amount of fentanyl-laced drugs is obviously out of control. And I guess the question that I would ask out of that is, when we talk about life expectancy, if it's, you know, 76 years on average for Black New Yorkers, 82 years on average for white New Yorkers, or the overall stat for everybody as a whole, it doesn't mean that people are living to 76 and living to 82 necessarily, and then succumbing earlier in old age. A lot of it is because some of these disparities that people are dying young, right? People are dying young from maternal and infant mortality being disparate, from the fentanyl that the caller, the listener writes about, from gun violence. So it's really, are the solutions in Healthy NYC largely focused there?
Yes, very much so. It's a both and question, right? We do need to protect vulnerable older adults who we saw bore the brunt of COVID, for instance. We need to protect them and center them in our population. But make no mistake, in our health agenda, but make no mistake, premature death below age 65 in this city in particular, but around the country, it's the same, disproportionately impacts communities of color. And so we have to center that work if we are going to reach our goals of life expectancy and mortality goals that were mentioned.
So we already have drug prevention plans. There are diet promotion campaigns always. Yep. There's, you know, all kinds of debate over how to prevent gun violence in the city. What's at the heart of Healthy NYC that you and the mayor and city council hope will make a difference?
Well, at the heart of Healthy NYC is actually taking the step of setting these goals and putting them out there. And then those plans that have been launched prior or will continue to get announced, it's about really laddering up to something bigger than any one initiative can achieve. You know, it's really putting in the GPS coordinates for health in our city. One of the things that was so remarkable during COVID, even though it was a really challenging time, is that everyone's focus was that one disease. And everyone really came around the table and said, how do we attack this in an emergency? And one of the questions we were asking as we exited the worst of the pandemic is, what is our North Star? What's the direction? And why are we doing this? What's the big why here? And ultimately, if we're not living in a city and in a society where we can expect to live healthier and longer, where we can pass that expectation on to our children, then what are we doing this for? And this is our response. This is going to now be a permanent feature of city planning. Every 5 years, we have to come back to the table and establish a new goal or track our progress towards the existing one and reassess what's killing New Yorkers too soon. This is thousands of people, 7,000 people or more. We can avert preventable deaths if we achieve all of our Healthy NYC goals. That's brothers, sisters, mothers, children who would be otherwise taken from us too soon. And so this is our North Star. This is our GPS coordinates for health in New York City now and into the future.
We have 2 minutes left in the segment. Let me get you quickly, briefly on two other health-related news stories. One is, the CDC recently changed the COVID isolation guidelines, right? If you're fever-free for 24 hours, even if you're coughing and testing positive, you can go back to school, go back to work. At the same time that they've now recommended that senior citizens over 65 get another COVID shot of the same vaccine that people got in the fall. So does that make any sense? It seems like mixed messages. Be more concerned, be less concerned.
Well, I think the adaptation of the isolation guidance is really about when can people get back to everyday life? And how do we live with COVID in a way that is commensurate with its risk to the general population? But for high-risk New Yorkers, particularly people over 65, people with underlying chronic conditions, immunosuppression, what have you, taking that extra booster, that extra dose, I should say, of the updated COVID-19 vaccine is really about updating your immunity so you can prevent severe illness and death.
Right. But I thought,
so I don't
thought
think it's
we've
mixed
been...
messaging. I think it's actually about where we are in terms of where COVID is in its generalized risk, and where people want to be in terms of getting back to some semblance.
Well, maybe if society is allowing more COVID contagious people to go back into the workplace, into schools, into everywhere, then the most vulnerable need to protect themselves more. Maybe it's consistent on that basis.
And Brian, it's clear that in the guidance is not saying do nothing. The guidance says if you're going to go back to work, wear a mask for 5 days until you're totally symptom free.
You know, but I also thought
stay away from people who you know are older and
yes.
have vulnerable conditions.
I'm glad you made that point. But I thought we've also been told that for people who've gotten most of their series of COVID shots since the beginning of the pandemic, the protection against serious illness persists, and the new boosters or new rounds of shots are mostly to prevent you from getting it at all. Is that wrong?
Yeah, that's not entirely accurate. It certainly your risk of getting it is reduced. But if you've been taking all of your shots, you have fairly significant immunity. But one thing is clear about the vaccine-derived immunity as well as infection-derived immunity. It's not permanent, right? And so it does fade over time. It does these neutralizing antibodies that the vaccine is meant to elicit, they don't last forever. So it's not like a measles vaccine or a polio vaccine, which has 10 years of immunity or more, right? This is a shorter term vaccine like a flu shot, which you need to update every year. So I think that's the mode we're moving to is this annualized COVID
or every
vaccine,
six
and
months.
High-risk people need to take another dose.
Yeah. So you've kind of segued into my last question, and we're over time. So if you can do this in like 30 seconds,
sure.
You're concerned about the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine for babies and toddlers, right? Is that declining in use?
Well, New York is still doing pretty well, but yes, we're seeing declines all across this country, slight declines all across this country. And we're honestly, the anti-vax movement has become stronger and stronger. And we need parents in particular to redouble their efforts. And we need to redouble our efforts in public health departments to get people vaccinated, get young people vaccinated prior to school, to get young babies up to speed, up to date on their measles vaccines, as well as many other, because we these are diseases of the past, which are now coming back in pockets.
Do you
Luckily,
think that the
New York
anti,
City is not,
anti-COVID vaccine movement has now generalized even more to these, newborn?
Yes,
and
very clear. It's very clear, and the data is very clear that it's had a contagious effect on overall vaccine confidence. And so it's on us to build back that confidence and to talk about why it's so important to stay up to date on routine childhood immunizations.
New York City Health and Mental Hygiene Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Vasan. We've covered a lot of ground. We always appreciate when you come on with us and do that. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you, Brian. Thank you so much.